Welcome to Lunchtime Classics on 90.5 FM WUOL. Broadcasting live from WUOL's performance studio on 4th Street in downtown Louisville. Now, here's your host, Alan Brandt.
Good afternoon. Thanks for being here. We've got a capacity audience for our last Kentucky Opera production of the season as the part of their Lunch and Listen series, as they present Poulenc's Dialogues of the Carmelites. And we're very proud to be able to host this fine group and these amazing musicians today. So, yes, we are live at the Performance Studio in downtown Louisville, and we do this every Wednesday. Go to our website at wuol.org and see our schedule for the rest of the year. Once again, and for the last time this season, I'd like to welcome the General Director of Kentucky Opera to talk about the Poulenc opus for today, David Roth.
Thank you, Alan. And a special thanks to our audience today and our audience out there on the airwaves as we begin Kentucky Opera's live broadcast of Lunch and Listen, our partnership program with the Public Radio Partnership, Classical 90.5's Lunchtime Classics, as well as Metro TV, who is taping this for future broadcasts. Lunch and Listen is Kentucky Opera's opportunity to introduce our audiences to each of our opera productions through performances and dialogues, discussions with our guest artists. Before we begin, I want to acknowledge our sponsors for supporting another great season of Grand Opera with Kentucky Opera. The Brown-Forman Corporation, our sponsor of the 2007-2008 Brown-Forman fall season. Stockyards Bank, the production sponsor of Dialogues of the Carmelites. And we would like to acknowledge the annual support that we receive from Delta Airlines, the Galt House, Bluegrass Motorsport, Metro Louisville, the Kentucky Arts Council. And finally, as a member organization, we want to thank our friends at the Fund for the Arts for their continued support of the Kentucky Opera. So please join me in a round of applause, showing our support and appreciation for these sponsors. Thank you. On Friday, November 30th, and Sunday, December 1st, Kentucky Opera will present the final production of our 2007-2008 Brown-Forman fall season, Francis Poulenc's Dialogues of the Carmelites. The opera is set during the Reign of Terror, lasting from about 1793 to 1794, a particularly murderous period of the French Revolution, following the collapse of the monarchy. The opera is based on historical events surrounding the martyrdom of 16 Carmelite nuns who chose to defy the revolution. As a result, they were arrested and then executed at the Place de la Révolution for refusing to renounce their religious order. The inspiration for the opera started with the novel Song at the Scaffold, written by Gertrude von Lafort in 1931 and based on writings of Mother Marie of the Incarnation, who had survived her martyred sisters. Gertrude wrote in her novel, just as Hitler and the Nazi regime were rising to power in post-war Germany, her fear and terror translated into the central character of this story, Blanche de la Force. The novel was then adapted into a dialogue format by George Bernanos, which was intended to be made into a film. The dialogues were then edited by Poulenc and completed as an opera, which was first performed at La Scala in Milan on January 26, 1957. Before we get into our performance section today, I want to take a moment and turn our attention to this wonderful group of guest artists we have here in the studio today. We're delighted to have with us a number of the singers from our production of the Dialogues of the Carmelites. Let me just begin at the far end, and I'll introduce each of them, and then we can applaud at the end just in the interest of time. Singing the role of Mother Marie is Jeannie Greenwald, back with us again, from her production of Azucena in Trovatore. Doing her Kentucky Opera debut is Susanna Phillips in the role of Blanche. Next to her is Janice Meyerson singing Madame de Croissy. Singing the role of the first commissioner is one of our studio artists, Chuck Chandler. And also we have, Constance, singing the role of Constance, Caroline Wara. Next to her is Brian Stuckey, singing the role of the Chevalier, Blanche's brother. Next to him is Dan Collins, also a studio artist who's singing the second commissioner and the jailer today. And we have Emily Pulley, who is doing Madame Lidoin, the new prioress. And finally, we're delighted to have with us both the maestro and the stage director of this production, Maestro Chris Larkin, and our stage director, Casey Stengel, who you in the studio, it's just slightly behind me. So give a round of applause to all of these guest artists, please. Welcome, everyone, and we'll have a chance to chat with our guest artists later on in the program. Poulenc's compositional structure in this opera follows the dialogue format adapted from the Bernanos play, each constructed into three acts with four tableaus in each act. With most of the dialogue being extracted directly from the play, there are not arias or ensembles per se, such as musical numbers in the case of popular 19th century lyric opera. Poulenc instead uses musical themes and orchestral color, which he then connects to the dialogues in a manner that heightens the dramatic tension and pulls us through the work to its dramatic conclusion. Today, we have taken excerpts from several scenes that will give you a taste of this musical style, which so effectively connects the music to the drama. Now, the opera itself opens in the home of the Marquis de la Force, who discusses with his son, the Chevalier, the rising tide of discontent among the masses and their concern for Blanche's fearful and weak nature. Blanche enters and expresses her desire to leave her family home and join the Carmelite order. This takes us to the second tableau of Act One, where we find Blanche at the convent being interviewed by the old prioress, Madame de Croissy. She seeks to find Blanche's true intentions before she will permit her to enter. So if you will, please welcome with me to the microphone Janice Meyerson and Susanna Phillips, singing the roles of Madame de Croissy and Blanche de la Force, respectively. One note, we will perform this opera and the scenes today in English and not in the original French language. So Janice and Susanna, welcome. Thank you.
Freed from all, if she is not also set free. judgment itself. I see the formidable rules of our order do not seem to frighten you. They attract me. Oh, yes, your heart is generous and noble. What has drawn you to us?
Your reverence commands that I should answer with absolute frankness.
Yes!
Very well, the quest for a life that's heroic.
The quest for a life that's heroic. Or for a certain manner of living, which you believe quite wrongly, would make it easier for you to be heroic, would put it, so to speak, in the palm of your hand.
My reverend mother, I can assure you I have never harbored such desires.
The most dangerous of our desires are those that we like to call our illusions.
Thank you. Thank you, Janice and Susanna. And I would like to, sorry, they were back on the air now. Thank you so much for that beautiful rendition. And please come back to the microphone. We would just want to find out a little bit about each of you. Yes. And just as a point of reference, the other speaking microphones that we have. Starting with Susanna, welcome to Louisville. This is your debut with Kentucky Opera.
I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, we're delighted to have you. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was born in Alabama, born and raised. went to school in New York City, moved to Chicago to sing with the Lyric Opera there, and now that's where I'm based.
How many years have you been singing with the Lyric Opera?
I was a member of their Young Artist Program for 2 years, and that ended in April, so now I'm an independent contractor, per se.
Yes, but you have been out singing. I understand you had a great success with Fiordaligi this summer in Santa Fe.
I had a wonderful experience with the Santa Fe Opera this summer, singing Fiordaligi and Così fan tutte, with a wonderful cast and great director. And it was a wonderful experience.
Excellent. Anything coming up for you now?
Well, Blanche de la Force and Dialogues of the Carmelites. other than that, I'm doing Elmira in Croesus by Reinhard Kaiser with Minnesota Opera, Don Anna with Utah Opera in Don Giovanni, and The Marriage of Figaro with the Santa Fe Opera next summer.
Wonderful. We look forward to seeing you in one of those productions. Thank you, Susanna.
Thank you.
Janice, welcome to Louisville.
Thank you.
And this is not your debut. You have been here before.
No, I sang Amneris and Aida.
Closer.
Mm-hmm. Did you hear that? I sang Amneris and
Aida.
There
we go.
Yes.
How long ago? A couple years?
No, I think it was 20 years ago.
Wow.
And now I am old enough to sing the Old Prioress.
That's great.
But by the way, I did. Four of the characters in this opera are based on real historical figures.
Yes.
One of them is me. And I found out she's 49. And she's not 85. So there.
Well, welcome. What have you been up to lately?
I just got back from South America. I was singing Carmen in Montevideo, Uruguay at the Teatro Solis. I was thinking from the urge to the dirge because this is an opera I'm going to die in.
Yes.
In a different way from Carmen.
And that's a beautiful city, too. I was there 2 years ago.
It's great.
Yes, very nice. Well, thank you both for joining us for this production, and thanks for coming today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
In the third tableau of Act One, we meet the vibrant sister Constance, who quickly befriends Blanche, as both are the newest members to join the convent. In this scene, the two novices discuss the grave illness of the old prioress and Constance's belief that she will not die alone but with her sister Blanche. In this excerpt, Constance recounts for Blanche her life before joining the order. So please welcome to the microphone Caroline Wara, who will sing Constance, and Susanna Phillips again to sing Blanche.
it's a time of battle. Say the merchants in the town are hoarding all the grain, and that in Paris there is no bread. Look! Why, here's the iron we had thought was lost. We looked everywhere, but without success. Come and see how the handle has been covered up with flannel. No more will we hear, O Sister Jeanne of the Holy Child, crying as she blows on her fingers. I bet you no one would press it all with this confounded iron. I bet! How I used to bite my tongue to keep myself from laughing. Yet how I love to hear it. Her I bet made me think of the country and of our good village folk in tea. Sister Blusher, 7 weeks before the fair enter this life, how we enjoyed ourselves at my older brother's wedding. All the village folk were gathered together, 10 little girls to present a bouquet. While violins were playing, all with my two days, dined at the chateau, danced a together from the closet. How I wailed, first I passed out. I've never been so happy. Those simple people adored me to distraction.
You gotta keep them wanting more, right?
Yes. Thank you both. Thank you very much. Caroline, excuse me. Also, from that singing. So, welcome to Louisville.
Thank you.
This is your debut for Kentucky Opera, I believe.
Correct.
Yes. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I grew up in Wisconsin, and I went to school in Indiana University in Bloomington, just up the road. And I've moved to New York City, and I've been singing for 6 years with Glimmerglass Opera in Cooperstown and for 6 years at New York City Opera.
Wonderful. Tell us some of the roles that you've been performing.
Well, I actually do a lot of 20th century music. I do a lot of Handel and Mozart, and then the two extremes is what I like, actually. I guess the most exciting thing that I've recently done was I was nominated for a Grammy for a recording of a new opera called The Mines of Sulphur, and by Richard Rodney Bennett. So that's kind
wonderful.
Of the exciting thing.
Yes, yes, it is, very much. Well, we are delighted to have both of you here. Thank you so much again, Susanna, and thank you, Caroline.
Thank you.
Wonderful performance. I would like to invite now our stage director for Dialogues of the Carmelites, Casey Stengel, to the microphone. And we want to first introduce the audience to you, Casey, but we also want to talk a little bit about this production from the theatrical and dramatic standpoint. So welcome, Casey. We're glad to have you.
Thank you very much.
This is also your Kentucky Opera debut.
It is. It's my first visit to Louisville, and I'm enjoying myself very much.
Excellent. We met a few years ago for the first time, although we were working in Minneapolis together for many years, but in separate productions, we never really ran into each other.
Right.
Until we met in California.
At a garage sale.
And we hit it off, and we brought you to Fort Worth to direct this production. So this is actually your second time investigating this piece.
It is, and I have to say that doing it in Fort Worth was one of the just top opera directing experiences I've had. It was it's such a wonderful piece. It's so there's so much richness of both the music and the emotionality and the texture of it. This production is also quite beautiful. It's a very spare production, so the scenery, each scene tends to have one or two scenic elements in it that are quite large, so there's this sense of the singers and in the world that they're in being kind of engulfed by the world that is surrounding them. But the spareness of it really puts the focus on the singers and on the performers, so they are kind of front and center, and it's very, very simple staging, but I think quite effective. The piece kind of ruminates on the nature of both faith and courage and how we respond to crisis and death, both in a society at large, but also personally. And it's a very poignant piece highlighted by the final scene in which the nuns, as David was explaining earlier, who have refused to renounce their order, are now sent to the guillotine, and they're all there in shackles, essentially, and we see just this big ramp leading up to an offstage guillotine, and one by one they go up the ramp, and we actually hear the sound of the blade in the score, and one by one they drop out. So what starts with this huge chorus of voices of nuns singing a beautiful Latin hymn slowly, inexorably leads to just a single voice that is finally also extinguished. But that voice of Blanche, in meeting her death, in finding the courage to do this, actually comes into her own and find, kind of blossoms as a person. So there's a wonderful poignancy there of seeing a person as she meets death become the person that she was always intended to be. So it has a kind of oddly hopeful yet tragic ending. Very French.
Janice Meyerson was mentioning earlier about several of these characters, the main characters being based in real characters from that period. Blanche de la Force is not the principal character.
Right.
When you consider this piece as a director, what do you see in Blanche?
Well, we were talking about this. Susanna and I were just having a conversation about this yesterday. I think she's a young woman. She grew up without a mother. Her mother was killed in a sort of riot that in some way foreshadows what's going to happen in the French Revolution. And she's grown up very sheltered. I think she's a very serious woman. And her seriousness is mistaken for weakness. And she's kind of never really encouraged to become the person that she could become. And so she gets kind of branded as fearful and weak, and as tends to happen with that, what we are, what people tell us we are. So those become self-fulfilling prophecies. So she's become someone who's kind of frightened of her own shadow, unsure of herself, not confident. And her brother and father, although they love her very much, they don't really quite know what to do with her. So she's someone who has grown up kind of always in a shadow, and now the terror, the literal terror of the French Revolution is invading her space, and she feels that she has to find a way to escape that. And the convent feels like a place, not only a safe place, but a place that she might be able to find herself and confront her fears and marry her, find a way through God to confront the fear that she has and hopefully be liberated from it, which I think she ultimately does. So it's a very complicated character, but I think you're going to be in for a treat with Susanna. She's not only a beautiful voice, but very smart actress as well, and I think will add a lot of depth to that role.
So in a sense, we really see her spiritual path.
Absolutely.
Through this
piece. Yeah. Her journey is definitely the journey of the play, of the opera. Sorry, I direct theater too. So it's definitely, we follow kind of her path spiritually, which sort of mirrors, you know, the societal picture as well. But it's definitely her spiritual awakening, liberation that is the culmination of the piece.
And in that sense, then, that mirrors the spiritual awakening of all the nuns at this point, which
Absolutely.
Is a very powerful ending.
It's one of the most powerful endings of an opera I've ever been involved in, but also witnessed. The idea of these women who have, you know, taken a vow of silence and poverty and just expected to spend their days in very quiet contemplation, actually having to face execution and being willing to do that is, I can't imagine what I would do in that situation. So we see, you know, people being put to the test and how they react to it. And I think, you know, that's something in our times today we can also relate to.
I have enough time, and I would like to get to one little point. You were talking about this production, the set that you're using, and it being very sparse. In fact, it's very open. How do you approach that with some of the really confined, almost claustrophobic spaces that we're dealing with that are interpreted even in the stories of the individual artists?
I actually think the spareness of it helps. And then light is a big, big factor in this production. The lighting designer has a big job, and we work together in Fort Worth. He does a beautiful job. As I said, these scenic pieces are huge. So they create a sense of the world kind of coming down upon and being enveloping these characters. So that in and of itself kind of creates almost a boxed in feeling. Mm-hmm. But then the light really helps to define space and keep them in these kind of tightly constricted places. And it's you know, it's not a lot of movement. There's, you know, there's no tap dances or or anything.
But you do have like 12 scenes that you're working with, and very 12 distinct scenes in location and place.
Absolutely. It's a lot of staging and a lot of communicating a lot of different locations and places and moods. But it's done primarily through the language of the piece, which is so rich, and also through defining these places through, you know, one or two key elements and light. And so then, as I said, it really puts the focus on the words and the singers.
One of the things that I really liked about the production, the former production in Fort Worth, was your use of the interludes and the development of those as part of the story, not going to a blackout and having it as a musical moment, but continuing on with the dramatic element.
Yes, we use pretty much all the music is used to tell story, to continue to advance character, and to, you know, help us get to know, you know, add little details to who these people are. And I think it's very effective. There's actually, it's interesting because I was working with the Chorus of Nuns the other night, and we spent a good 2 hours working on staging before they ever sang a note, because there are so many things that they're doing that add to the kind of mood and idea of the piece that don't have anything to do with singing words. The Chorus of Nuns is really important in this show too. They provide this kind of bedrock for the piece throughout. They're not all that present vocally. I mean, they have quite a bit to sing, but it's not tons of singing, but they are visually on stage a lot and add an enormous amount of texture to it. So we're fortunate to have a great chorus of Louisville performers to help us with that.
Hey, yes, we are very fortunate. Well, thank you, Casey. We appreciate you being here, and thank you for coming back to do this production.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Continuing on now, excuse me. Act two begins after the death of the old prioress, with Constance and Blanche mourning the passing of their mother superior as they pray in the chapel. Constance leaves Blanche alone for a moment, who then panics and attempts to run out. She is stopped and chastised by Mother Marie for letting her fears overtake her. The second tableau of Act two introduces us to the new prioress, Madame Lidoine. In this excerpt, she attempts to comfort the mourning nuns and promises to bring strength to them in their hour of grief, reminding them that they are humble women who have come here to pray to God. So already at our microphone, let's welcome our Madame Lidoine, Emily Pulley, to sing this excerpt from the second tableau of Act Two.
Of this earth look down upon and hold in scorn.
Thank you, Emily. Beautiful. Well done. Well, welcome. Welcome to Louisville. And I'm not sure, but is this your Kentucky Opera debut?
This is indeed my Kentucky Opera debut. I was supposed to be here a while back, but I had something else that came up, and they were good enough to release me for that. But I'm very happy to be here now.
Well, good for us that you came back. We're delighted to have you. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm originally from College Station, Texas, Giga Maggie's. And I have an apartment in New York, and so I divide my time between New York and Texas. And
you still go down to Texas often?
Oh, I'm basically based out of Texas.
Oh, very nice.
So I can still use y'all and fix into correctly in a sentence.
Well done. Yeah. What's coming up for you?
Well, I have some interesting things. Like Caroline, I do a lot of 20th century work. And so this spring I'm getting to do my first Turn of the Screw. I'm very excited about that.
Wonderful.
And also doing Cold Sassy Tree. And this summer I'm doing Susanna.
So, wonderful.
And I think I have some other rep, some like, you know, non-20th century rep in there. But
have you sung Susanna before?
It's one of the roles I've done more frequently than any other. In fact, the last time I did it was with our fantastic conductor, Mr. Larkin. Who will be speaking with shortly.
Yeah.
And since it's a role I've done so often, you know, you think, well, surely I've explored every facet of this piece. But I think that last production, there were so many things that just seemed brand new, and a lot of that was due to our wonderful conductor and our terrific director, and it was a great experience.
Where will you be singing The Governess?
Governess, I'm singing with Sacramento Opera. they lost their governess, and so
how fortunate,
just like
for
Mary
them.
Poppins, I came floating down, and not quite like Mary Poppins, but you get the idea.
Yes, best of luck with that one.
Thank you very much.
Best of luck. Well, thank you, Emily, for being with us. So it's time now. I would like to bring our maestro, Chris Larkin, to the microphone. Welcome, Chris. We're delighted to have you here.
Thank you, David. It's great
to be
here.
You have been with Kentucky Opera before.
A few years back, I did the Wild West version of Don Pasquale.
Ah, yes.
Ernesto sings his lament in a bubble bath.
Yeah. We did that production in Fort Worth. That was David Gately who put that together.
David Gately.
Wonderful
yes.
show.
It was great. Great production.
Well, Chris, let's dive right in. Let's talk a little bit about this score, about the composition with Poulenc.
Well, it's an incredible piece. It is so... such a dramatically based piece and a textually based piece. You know, Poulenc was very sensitive to having the piece done in the local language. So even though he was a French composer, the piece premiered at La Scala in Milan and was premiered in Italian. And he would make the necessary changes to rhythms to accommodate the language. And even with supertitles today, I think he would have insisted that it still be done in the native tongue, just because of the immediacy of the language. It becomes much more immediate to the audience.
Right. I must say, from my own perspective, and I do know the French, and I've seen several productions in the French, but I've worked on it in English. And as well as I know this piece, I still am disconnected with the dialogue.
David's choking up about the piece, I know.
Yeah. Sorry, it's that Ohio River Valley again. But there is a disconnect for us in the vernacular in English to really dive into these characters and dive into the language, which is so important in this particular piece.
It is. Just yesterday in rehearsal, we were, you know, sometimes the singers will just speak through the part to save their voices if we're going to do a scene several times. And at the end, it was just so powerful. They spoke it so well. I said, we should just do the play. But, you know, the music does add a considerable amount. And Poulenc is such a wonderful composer for the voice.
And most of the dialogue is directly extracted from the play.
Yes, it is.
And
yes,
Poulenc actually did some editing of his own.
A little bit.
Dialogue.
He trimmed it down to sort of make the story a little bit more concise. But basically, it is directly from that film, what was intended to be a film script, I guess, or a film score.
When you do that exercise with the singers, do you find it interesting, the differences between just speaking the dialogue and then going back to sing it with the music?
Well, Poulenc sets things so beautifully, and in his style, each syllable gets a note. So there are never more than one note on any given syllable, unless it's the chorus of nuns. All of a sudden, when we get to sort of the sort of chant-like chorus scenes with the sisters singing, then we'll have a little more melisma, but... Every syllable is given its own note in Poulenc's style. So it already is very conversational. But I think when the singers are speaking through a scene, it makes it even a little more direct that when they go back to the tune and see how beautifully Poulenc has said it, that it becomes even more ingrained into their character.
Now, you've been a conductor for many years. You've conducted many pieces. Do you find this Poulenc score... different than so many other lyric operas? Do you find there are challenges attached to it?
Well, I love it. It's such a beautiful score, and it's great for the orchestra. They get to play all these beautiful interludes, which you don't always get. We just closed Cenerentola in Portland last Saturday night, so this is something very different. And I was just thinking, this year I've had the opportunity to do Falstaff, Bohème, Cenerentola. I'm now doing this. Then I'll do Egisto of Cavalli, a Renaissance piece. After that, I do Angels in America, which was written in 2004. So I don't think I've skipped any period of
music.
Operatic music
no.
at this point.
Especially in the opera realm.
But this score is very special. It's such a dramatic piece, and it's great to work with Casey again on it because a lot of her background is in theater as well. And it's the final scene is, as she said, it's like nothing else written in opera. It's just so moving and so beautifully set.
Have you ever worked on any of Poulenc's other pieces? He wasn't a prolific opera
composer. No, he only wrote three operas. His early opera, Les Mamelles de Thérésias, it was 10 years before this, was his first opera. He was actually very nervous about writing opera. He was actually very insecure about his own ability to write an opera. He didn't know if he could sustain an evening's worth of work. He wrote a lot of song repertoire, so his vocal writing is beautiful. Mm-hmm. But this came to him. Originally, he was supposed to write a ballet, and then they proposed this subject to him.
When the commission came from Milan.
Right, right. It was originally a ballet project, and he said, oh, I wish someone would just give me a good opera libretto that I could set. And they came with this story, and he took it on, and what a beautiful job he did with it. And then the only other opera he has is Le Roi aux Men, mm-hmm. which was a couple of years after this.
One-act opera.
One-act, right. So he actually empathized with the character of Blanche, this sense of fear and overcoming fear. He wasn't classically trained. He didn't go to the Paris Conservatory, so he always had a little bit of an inferiority complex. So it was with great trepidation. And you can see the way it's sort of set in short vignettes.
Correct.
with these interludes. That's sort of his style, and he had so much song experience, and his work as an accompanist and pianist, also a very gifted pianist.
Do you approach the orchestra differently with a piece like this as compared to a more lyrical, more Rossini-esque opera?
Well, it's very different from Rossini, that's for sure. They enjoy
How do you approach
it, more,
it with
I think.
The orchestra, I guess?
Well, a lot of colors. You know, there's so many different colors, so many dramatic yes. gestures, and virtually every moment in the piece is dramatically motivated from the text. So that has to be conveyed in the orchestral sound and the quality of sound and the colors that you use.
Well, we're looking forward to hearing it and seeing you in this production. Thank you for being here, Chris.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Continuing on with the opera, in the third tableau of Act Two, the Chevalier goes to the convent to convince Blanche to return home with him. He tells her the convent is no longer safe because of the growing strength in the revolution. So, if you will, please welcome Brian Stuckey and Susanna Phillips again to the microphone for this excerpt of the most central scene of the opera, third tableau from Act Two.
Answer me, you have never once raised your eyes to me, and you have hardly listened. Can this be the welcome you owe to your brother?
God is my witness, I've no desire to cause you the slightest sorrow.
Let me come to the point. Our father feels it is unsafe for you to stay here any longer.
Possibly there may be danger, but I feel safe, and that's enough for me.
How can you explain the sudden change in the Blanche that I knew? There is something in your voice and your manner. You're so constrained and very ill at ease.
Fear.
This theme is hardly nobler than any other fear. You have to run the risk of fear as you run the risk of death. And it is this that calls for courage.
From this day on, I can only be the helpless and innocent victim of the will of our Lord.
Blush. Just now when I entered this room, you looked as if you surely would collapse from exhaustion. I thought I saw you beneath the feeble glimmer of this light, as if you were a vision of our childhood. It is just because we felt so awkward that we arrived at such strange and bitter words that seem to give offense. Would they have changed my little rabbit?
Oh, why must you forever fill me with doubt as with a poison that destroys? And from this poison I almost died. It's true, the past is gone forever.
You no longer are a afraid.
Where I am, nothing can harm me.
Very well. Goodbye, my darling.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Susanna. Susanna, just stay for a moment. I have a question for you. But Brian, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Kentucky Opera debut.
Yes.
First time here in Louisville.
Yes, it is.
Well, welcome. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm originally from the Northwest. I was raised in Washington State. Traveled around quite a bit. Lived in Chicago for a while. And I finished my graduate work about a year and a half ago just up the road at Indiana University. So this
Congratulations.
Thank you. So it's a pleasure to be back in this part of the country again.
Welcome. And you just finished Nadir, I believe.
Yes, that's right. I just finished Pearl Fishers with the Lyric Opera of Kansas City. So that was a great pleasure, and it's wonderful to be here continuing in the French repertoire.
We're delighted to have you. Yes. Susanna, a thought came to me, and I wanted to sort of approach it because Blanche is the pivotal character. She's everything in this opera. We follow her path. We follow her story. In looking at this scene, if you've considered it, if this is central to the story, if this is the one pivotal scene, what is the importance that you feel with Blanche in this particular moment, confronting her brother or her brother confronting you?
I feel that in this scene, Blanche is grasping at straws and trying to say everything correctly and trying to believe everything that's coming out of her mouth. She's saying all the right things, but at the end of the scene that we did not perform today, it is revealed that she told a lie and that she does not believe that she is this strong person, and that she's given in to her pride and sin in that respect. It is only at the end of the opera when she really encompasses all of her being without any fear. But it is in this scene where it is revealed that she is truly trying very hard, but is still very weak.
Do you think at this moment that she then realizes for the first time that that fear inside of her is real?
I think that's a very good way to put it.
We'll leave it at that then. Thank you, Susanna, and thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Wonderfully done. In the final tableau of Act Two, the father confessor bids goodbye to the sisters as he must go into hiding to escape persecution. An angry crowd is heard outside, and two officials enter the convent. The revolutionary government has decreed that religious gatherings and orders are illegal and must immediately disband. So here to sing the roles of the two commissioners are our studio artists, Daniel Collins and Chuck Chandler, along with Eugenie Greenwald performing Mother Marie.
Expulsion.
That depends upon no one but you.
Whereas it was decided by the Legislative Assembly in session the 17th of August, 1792. By the 1st of October next, all houses of retreat at present still occupied by the active members of religious societies and orders have to be vacated at once by the aforementioned parties and must be offered for sale with the full approval of the proper authorities.
Is there anything in this decree to which you object?
How can we possibly object? When you've left us nothing at all to decide. But it really is essential that we obtain some appropriate clues. Since you prohibit us from wearing the ones we have.
Are you then so very eager to throw off your silly clothes and to be dressed just like everybody else?
Surely you understand, it is not the uniform which makes a soldier fight. No matter what we wear, we are and always will be humble servants.
Our people have no more need of servants.
But they have truly a great need of martyrs, and this burden we are truly prepared to assume.
When there's death on every hand, to die is nothing.
To live is nothing when life is thoroughly debased and devoid of value, having no more worth than your paper money.
What you said would surely cost you very dear if you had been heard by anyone but me. Do you believe that I am like the rest of them? In the church at home, I served 2 years as sacristan. A noble priest, I loved him like a brother. Yet I've no choice but to howl with all the wolves.
You will forgive me, but I must ask you to prove your loyalty and goodwill.
I will manage somehow to get rid of the patrol. You will be alone until the workman comes later on tonight. But beware the blacksmith named Blancard, for he is an informer.
Thank you. Very nicely done. I have one more introduction that I must make. On the piano today, we have two of our artists. Excuse me. Emily Leather, our music director from the Studio Artist Program. Thank you, Emily. And we also have Kelly Kuo, who is back with us again for this production, our repetiteur for Dialogues of the Carmelites. Gentlemen, welcome. Introduce the audience to you.
My name is Daniel Collins in the studio, baritone, originally from Waco, Texas, not far south from College Station. I am living in D.C. now and have done the past two shows here and have four bits here in Dialogues of the Carmelites, this the second commissioner, also the first officer, the jailer, and some in the chorus. So you shouldn't miss me, I hope so.
Thank you, Daniel. Chuck, welcome. You're from the University of Kentucky.
Thank you. Yes, I am. I'm currently a doctoral student at the University of Kentucky, and hopefully, with any luck, I'll go back in the spring and finish. We'll see,
yes.
But it takes some time. It's a process. I was born in Richmond, Virginia, and we moved around quite a bit all through the Southeast. I now call the Carolinas home, which is where all of my family is, and so when I go home, that's where I go.
Great. Well, we're delighted to have you as one of our apprentices with the Studio Artist Program. University of Kentucky has joined us this year, and the University of Louisville will be joining us next year on the Apprentice Program with the Studio Artists. So thank you, Chuck.
Thank you.
Jeannie, great to have you back.
It's wonderful to be back.
You were here with us, as I said before, with Trovatori, singing
yes.
Azucena.
Yes, had a blast.
Well, we had a blast with you as well. That was a great production. Tell us a little bit about yourself again.
Well, I was born in New Orleans. I was raised in Columbus, Ohio, and I've been living in New York for years.
Yes. Still family back in Columbus?
No, a lot of friends.
A lot of good friends. Good.
So.
Well, thank you so much for joining us again for this show. We'll hopefully have you back again.
I hope so.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Jeannie. As the opera nears its climactic end, we see the 16 nuns at the scaffold against the mob of people gathered in the Place de la Révolution to witness their execution. The sisters sing together the Salve Regina while each walks up to the scaffold to her death. In this most haunting moment of the opera, the guillotine is heard as another voice drops out. The French Revolution itself went on for another 5 years, but this act of martyrdom by the Carmelites of Compiègne is believed to have brought an end to the Reign of Terror. It has been documented that the Place de la Révolution fell silent as 16 nuns climbed the scaffold singing their hymn to God. We hope you will join us for this production. Again, the production dates are November 30th, Friday at 8 p.m., and December 2nd at 2 p.m. To order tickets, you may call 584-7777, or you may check us out online at www.kyopera.org. We want to offer a special thanks today to our audience here in the studio, out there on the airwaves, to Public Radio Partnership, to Classical 90.5, and to Metro TV. We are delighted to have you with us today. We hope to see you at the opera. And we also want to announce that we will be doing a Mall of the Night Visitors with our studio artists on December 7th and 8th at the Fern Creek Christian Church. And for tickets for that, you may call our office, 584-4500. And we are also offering tickets on sale for Samson and Delilah, which is our concert opera co-production with the Louisville Orchestra on March 28th, 2008, with the music director of the Louisville Orchestra, George Mester, and Denise Graves and Stephen O'Mara. So we hope to see you all at the opera. Thank you for coming and joining us.
Thank you. David Roth from Kentucky Opera. And looking forward to this production. It sounds great, doesn't it? We will be coming back next Wednesday with Lunchtime Classics, so check WOL.org. Also, Classical 90.5 has a big song fest coming up on our own on Sunday, December 2nd at 3 o'clock at St. Martin of Tours Catholic Church. It's our third annual Christmas Choral Extravaganza. We have the U of L Cardinal Singers, world-class chorus there, and we just confirmed today Vocis Novae, along with St. Martin of Tours. So it's going to be an excellent time, and you can get tickets on the way out. So, anyway, thanks for being here. I'd like to thank P. Vincent Nevitt for running the house sound. We have Andrew High running the board, and we'll see you next time.